All right. Let's get fired up here. Hello and welcome to the next episode of Read Rothbard, the Read Rothbard podcast. My name is Daniel, and as always with me is Robert Johnson. How are we doing, Robert Johnson?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm ready to go. Let's do it. Let's talk. Let's talk about things right now.
Yeah, so we just had a little pre-show call prepping for the show, which really didn't lead to very much prepping, and I just said, you know what, let's just start recording. And yes, and you said, hey, do you want to like go through the list of topics? And I was like, no, just surprise me. Just surprise me.
Yeah. So you're going to be totally unprepared, and you won't have anything interesting to say. Good job.
How would that be any different than our previous five episodes?
Not different at all. You're right.
I ask. Cool. Hey, I do want to mention a couple of things. We've been running a couple of promotions at readrothbard.com, pushing an ad. So if you have a Pebble watch, you can get a free Murray Rothbard watch face that I designed with your art, Robert's art. And it looks really cool. So feel free to come check it out. Sign up at readrothbard.com, and it will be available to you complimentary, free.
That's right. Yeah. It's got some decent art. I recently did better art, and then Daniel thinks it has crazy eyes. But maybe look for that in the future. But right now, the current Pebble Watch design is really cool. You should go for it.
All right. So enough promoing, I guess. Let's move on to any topic of your choice. However, I will preface that I did grab some paperwork from the post office that called to my attention with big bright red letters that said, men, you must do this.
You want to do that first? Because this kind of plays into your life, your real life. This is going to affect you, probably, most likely, maybe.
Well, it has affected me, and it sort of harkens back a little bit to our previous episode. So this could conceivably be considered a part two to that, because there have been some other our previous episode was about gun control, or at least a fair amount of it was, and I've seen some recent stuff that just, you know, makes me want to, like, call some people out, but I won't. I'll say what they said, but I won't say who they are.
Just make me scream. Just scream.
Yeah. It's brutal, man. It's brutal. It's so hard not being a statist in a statist world.
Yeah. Because all these well-meaning people who just want the world to get better, but all they have is this, or all they think they have, is this violent mechanism to attempt to affect change and try to solve problems. But all you're doing is interjecting violence into an already violent situation. You're going to make it worse. But anyway, what were you saying?
Yeah. Well, I do feel partly responsible for ruining your life in that way. But, you know, I think we're better off for it.
Yeah, it remains to be seen.
Yeah. So I go to the post office to pick up a gift I got for my girls for their birthdays. And I see two pieces of paper on the counter, and it says men in big, you know, red, bold letters. Do the right thing. Register. Men 18 through 25. Do the right thing. Register. And in little, you know, marketing quirky font down below, it says, it's quick. It's easy. It's the law.
But is it really the right thing? Is it? Is it really?
So this is for the selective service system. So if you're a man, and, you know, since, like, 1979, I think this was implemented, you have to register with the government, letting them know that your address and Social Security number, other information, so that they can put you in the draft pool, conscript you, put you into involuntary servitude or slavery. And let me see if I'm violating any laws here by mentioning those two words together. Let's see. I probably am in some violation. Yeah, well, you know, I'm down with the ODD.
Me too.
Our oppositional defiance disorder, which is now in the DSM-5 and could be considered a mental illness and preclude me from having any weapons of any sort.
Yeah.
So selective service is related to the draft. The draft was a very unpopular thing during Vietnam. It's a previous episode we talked about Muhammad Ali, great champion in boxing, great showman. A lot of people looked up to him, and one would argue that one of his greatest accomplishments was resisting going into the draft. and not going to fight in Vietnam, he said that he had no quarrel with the people in Vietnam, and he was right. And he was stripped of his title and not allowed to fight for 3 years. I believe he got prison time for standing up for his belief. And I'll just let you know, for the Selective Service, if you don't register, guess what? It's a felony. And if you're prosecuted and convicted of failure to register, you may be fined up to $250,000, imprisoned for up to 5 years, or bonus round, both.
Booyah.
And you also may permanently lose eligibility for student financial aid, government employment, job training, U.S. citizenship status if you are a male immigrant. So I just, you know, you're walking through a post office. I know it's a government building, but you're basically threatened with murder if you don't fill out this piece of paper that says you're going to be willingly going over somewhere else to go kill other people. And I don't know what your stance on that is. Well, I do know what your stance is on that, but our people listening, person listening, might not know. So do you have any comment?
Do we know? It's been so long since I've looked into this. I mean, back when I think I was at the cutoff point on when I had to do it or not. I think I looked into it a little bit. But we're talking pre-internet, really. I mean, the internet back in the 90s was not super great. If you register for the Selective Service, are you then put into the military, like at the discretion of the government? Some government bureaucrat decides, hey, we need X number of people. Let's grab all these willing, so-called willing Selective Service people, and then we'll just throw them off to wherever we want, do whatever we want with them.
I'm glad you asked. I have an answer. And of course, they make it sound almost voluntary, you know. All right, so here's what it says. Registration is the process by which the U.S. government collects names and addresses of men aged 18 to 25 to use in case of a national emergency as determined by Congress and the President, which would require rapid expansion of the armed forces. Men are required to register within 30 days of their 18th birthday. Once men reach their 26th birthday, they can no longer register, as stated in the Military Selective Service Act.
So, at the discretion of the President and some supposedly majority act of Congress, then they can decide, hey, we need a bunch of troops. Let's activate all these people on this list.
And yeah, so it's effectively conscription or a draft. But
right.
They of course, want to know where you are, where you reside. The other paperwork says, men, have you moved? Change your address with us. And so it's an update form.
Yeah. So this is a big threat, and this is coercion. This is literally threatening you with essentially murder. We will – you have to do this. Either you go over and you potentially get murdered, and you have to murder, most likely, or you're in situations where you are told to murder. If not, we are going to initiate all this force against you.
Kidnap you. Fine you.
It doesn't get more immoral than this. I mean, if you're having trouble seeing why this is wrong, just imagine you yourself doing it or any other person doing it, going up to somebody and threatening them with all these punishments if they don't do what you say. And I think hopefully that makes it clear, just because you're in government doesn't give you some sort of special morality. There's the myth going around, and it's always around, and it's apparently in every country, and that by living in a certain area, you somehow give consent to be ruled over, to somehow give consent, just by the fact that you live somewhere, you give consent to a bunch of thugs running around claiming that they own you and that they own the property you live on, that they have the right to impose restrictions or fines or any kind of behavior upon you. This is a complete myth. This is the propaganda. You could call it mind control. You could call it whatever you want. But just because you happen to live in a specific area, any given area, you got to live on this planet somewhere, doesn't mean that anyone else, I don't care where they live or what area of the world they claim dominion over, has a right to threaten you, coerce you with anything. It's wrong. So there's my rant on that.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're invoking the standard statist argument that, well, you can always leave. And as you're kind of stating, like, it shouldn't even be that way. Like, it shouldn't be a matter of you leaving. Like, what gave them the right to be there versus you being there, you know? But beyond that, I don't know if any of these people have actually looked into the prospect of leaving, but it's rather damn difficult. And so does it really need to be incumbent upon the person who doesn't want to be harassed to uproot their entire life and move somewhere else at some great expense?
And since when do you need someone else's permission to go anywhere? I mean,
well,
when you were young,
been a passport.
Maybe you asked your parents if you needed to borrow the car or whatever. But when you're an adult, whose permission ought you truly request in order for you to go anywhere? I'm sorry. Nobody. the arbiters of travel. You think. Okay. Anyway.
No, I know where you're going. I know where you're going. And I was just talking about the logistics of it. You know, it's rather difficult to leave. It's expensive. It's cost prohibitive. You've got to go somewhere, and they're going to impose their rules on you as well. So it's not like you have an option to go to Libertopia, you know, some place where there aren't any of these rulers seeking dominion over you. So it's not as if you actually do have a choice.
You cut out there for a bit, so I'll just assume you said something very intelligent.
All right, can you hear me now?
I can. I just missed a big chunk of it. It's all good. Continue.
Okay, well, what I was saying was that it's not as if you actually have a legitimate choice to make, because you would have to move somewhere, even if it is at some great expense, and you would just be subjected, apparently, to their rules and wish to be having dominion over you.
Yeah, to borrow a phrase from Steph, I mean, you're moving from one tax farm to another. Everywhere you go, there is somebody claiming dominion over you, claiming some sort of authority. And as I've said many times, and I'll say it many millions of more times, authority is a threat. Do what I say, or else I will inflict physical harm on you. I will attack you. I will rob you. All it does is identify the thugs. You got someone claiming authority. You got someone who is willing to initiate physical force against you. These people are thugs, and they're everywhere. No matter where you go, there is no, like Dan's saying, there's no Libertopia. Everybody's claimed, all the land on the planet is essentially claimed. There are less governed places. There are, but I don't know if there's any non-governed places. Maybe Antarctica, maybe. But still, it's not on the person that just wants to be free to have to want to leave. It's not the onus on me to leave. I have the right to not be messed with, just like everyone else. Everyone has that right. It's not a positive right because everybody's got it.
Yeah, though that right is never respected, and it's unfortunate. But, you know, even if you followed up with this statist argument and said, okay, fine, I will leave at great expense and choose a less governed area, guess what? You still are obligated to pay tax to the U.S. government. So even if you leave, you're not free, you know?
Now,
only one other country in the world does this. The U.S. and one other country.
Well, I don't know the other country. What's the other country, Daniel?
Eritrea in East Africa. But they're the only two countries in the world that no matter where you go, you must report your earnings, and if you're over a certain threshold, pay tax. Now, to be fair, the threshold is somewhat higher than if you lived in the U.S., so I think you can earn something in the neighborhood of $100,000 and not pay any tax, but you must report it.
Hmm. Is that true even if you renounce your citizenship? You know?
No, I don't think so, but that has a whole other series of consequences. I don't know if you would be allowed to come back, even for visitation.
Right. Yeah. You got to live all the rules that these bureaucrats come up with to protect their investments.
Now, it is still a rare thing for people to renounce a citizenship, but it has increased in recent years. I don't know about the last several years, but leading up to the financial crisis and a few years after, it had been going up from like a few hundred a year to several thousand people a year doing the renouncing. Now that the financial crisis, quote unquote, is apparently glossed over, or you know, enough money has been put into the system to sort of prop it up like it's Weekend at Bernie's Part 4.
Mm-hmm.
That could actually have several meanings, but basically it's still like a very small amount of people that actually do that, and you know, like I was saying, it's really a challenging thing to do, and it limits your options once you've done it.
Mm. Going back to the draft issue with the whole selective service now applying to women, is that right? Has it been passed, you know?
Yeah, well, don't you know that the buzzwords have been gender and transgender equality in you know, recent media? And so the Senate just passed a bill saying that, well, because, you know, everyone's equal and women have been excluded from needing to be part of the selective service, now they should be. And I don't know if it's like a fully, you know, passed thing. It's only gone through the Senate. And it's got there's things that I remember from Conjunction Junction or whatever, like how a bill gets made and a law gets passed or whatever. And you know, I'm sure it's mostly fantasy anyway, but I almost don't want to know about that shit. But I don't know if it's an official law yet.
Okay. Now, what do you think of this argument? There was one kind of, you know, you send me these Economic Policy Journal and other type, Lou Rockwell type stuff, and there was one kind of silver lining to this horrific thunderclap argument that one guy made in the comments section, and it was, well, now that the draft may apply to women as well, and selective service is now applying to women as well, it increases the incentive for the citizens of the country to oppose future war, since their daughters now are also might be called upon to murder and to get murdered. What do you think of that argument?
It's maybe an argument. I don't know how much water it holds because, I mean, I only have daughters, but if I had a son, I would feel equally like I don't want you to be kidnapped and sent off to go murder people.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just because it's women, I mean, maybe there's a little bit of more compassion in general, like in the general populace.
But 48% more, or 52% more people, right?
Right, yeah, so there's more people in the pool.
So there's more people in the pool to care about, regardless of their gender.
Okay, yeah, okay. Remove the gender component and just look at the quantitative, then sure. Yeah, more people are affected, and therefore, you know, any small percentage of resistance is effectively doubled or more.
Right.
So now, I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, we're talking silver linings here. I mean, we're not saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a horrible thing. Like, I don't want to say it's a good thing at all, but anything that pushes people away from supporting it is a good thing.
Right.
And I'm sure that's another felony I've just committed on some level. But, you know, it reminds me of John Fogerty and Creedence. You know, I ain't no senator's son.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, because they always got out of it. Anyone in a position of power who makes the decisions on who gets sent to go kill and die for, whatever, you know, they're not directly affected. They don't go themselves, and they rarely send their own children. And I'm sure it happens from time to time. And anytime it does, I'm sure it's a big, like, media, you know, like, oh, you know, this guy's son went, blah, 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 how great. And how patriotic.
It is. Man, there are a couple, and it's usually sold that way.
Yeah, we're going to get so much fucking hate mail.
Yeah.
You know, if anyone listens to this. Yeah. But, you know, this reminds me, I was telling you the other day about there's a meme going around from Jon Stewart saying that he thought that a two-year commitment for all young people in the country should be like either military or some kind of public service. And so many people liked it and shared it and commented and oh, how amazing is this? How amazing is that? I mean, the last I checked, slavery was a pretty bad thing, right?
Yeah, this is the Swiss style of service where I think every young child has to spend 2 years in the military in Switzerland or something like that. You know, it helps indoctrinate. It helps to maybe instill a sense of discipline and reminding that, you know, punishments and that sort of thing. I mean, I know people that come out of the Marine Corps and the military, they're horrified by their experiences of war, but a lot of them make a lot of really good friends and really appreciate the regimented and disciplined lifestyle that they get out of it. Maybe that's part of it. This idea that, you're somehow paying your debt to society just by having to be born in a certain area, that somehow you have incurred a debt that you owe somebody else because of
all that argument's been made to me before, that, you know,
yeah.
I got educated in the system and how, who am I to speak ill of it?
Right.
But, you know, that kind of reminds me of people who talk about veterans and people in the military have gone to fight to defend us in some way. And, you know, In what way? Like, was Hitler going to come to the U.S.? Was Iraq? Was Saddam Hussein going to come here? You know, like, are they really defending us? Were they defending us in Korea? Were they defending us in Vietnam? Were they defending us in Panama, in Grenada, in Yugoslavia? You know, all these things, all these adventures. Like, who are they defending? It seemed rather offensive rather than defensive.
Well, they're all completely offensive. I mean, you would say, you could argue that they are defending U.S. interests, usually, you know, resources. But those are for special interest groups and individuals and that sort of thing, cronyism. I mean, maybe we benefited, but at no time was, I mean, did I ever give my consent? I never asked anybody to go murder anybody for me. So don't tell me that you protected my freedom and now I owe you something.
Would you consider that maybe, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you might have bought into that a little bit before you kind of became a little bit more philosophically aware?
I was always of the mind, you know, I was a big kind of like war buff, history buff. Like I watched a ton of World War II documentaries and World War II movies and Vietnam War, and I read up on that kind of stuff. And it's clear that if you look at the history, like you were saying, Hitler, maybe he wanted to rule the world. He had no designs or even close to the ability to invade the United States. I mean, that's just a joke. And the whole, one of the big tropes that's trotted out a lot when you're talking about World War II especially is the idea that, or at least I've been seeing lately when I was watching like Thin Red Line and Saving Private Ryan, they kind of paint it as a democracy versus national socialism debate. And you're basically talking about two different statist doctrines where they're both involve immoral, horrific attacks on the people that they claim to rule. So it's two different immoral systems clashing. Democracy seems to be loved over here, but it's equally horrific. I mean, people forget that Hitler was democratically elected. They claim it to be some sort of like an ethical or a moral issue. Like we're saving the world for democracy. Well, forgive me if I don't thank you for that. Not to say that Hitler's great, obviously not. He's horrific. But if you're claiming that the Allied powers were great, well, excuse me, but they weren't.
Well, yeah, wasn't Stalin like a flip-flopper? He was on Hitler's side and then not on Hitler's side. And
yeah,
didn't he commit several genocides and imprisonments and
he murdered,
millions
yeah.
and millions of deaths?
Millions and millions and millions, yeah. I forget what it is, but it's almost 100 million, maybe more. I don't know. Way more than died in World War II, and a lot of people died in World War II. But, yeah, you know, democracy is loved, but, you know, it's three 19-year-old guys and your teenage daughter voting on what to do that night. I mean, it's horrific, and people don't seem to see the violence in it. Yeah, it's really frustrating.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, anyone who's interested in the history on these things, I'd recommend two sources, and that would be anything by Ralph Rako. He's great on the history of the Industrial Revolution, World War I, and World War II. And another guy who's really good is Robert Higgs. And he talks about the ratchet effect and all of the things that going to war helps mobilize and get certain things passed that wouldn't otherwise be passed. And every time it happens, you know, you ratchet it forward and then you back it off a little bit, but a little bit further than before. And before you know, it becomes a new normal, right? It's what do you call that? Is it like a normalization? There's a word for it.
Incrementalism.
Yeah, incrementalism. So it always feels like you're as you get acclimated to the new reality. You know, you look back 10 years and you can't believe.
Yeah, you convince yourself that you're free, and you're just acclimating yourself to the new tyranny, saying, well, this is the new baseline tyranny, and I'm still free, so this must be good. It must be more free than the rest of the world. So, right?
Yeah, but, you know, anytime that there's a government license or registration or anything, I mean, it's basically going to them for a hall pass for permission that you usually have to pay for, to do something that you should be able to do anyway?
That's right. Absolutely, my friend.
Well, I'm sure we beat the shit out of that one. So why don't you surprise me with another topic?
All right, buddy. So I saw The War of the Worlds last night with Tom Cruise and directed by old Steve Spielberg. And there was a kind of an interesting moral event in the movie. It was about two-thirds of the way in. And let me just set the scene for you. Okay, Tom Cruise. He's a dock worker, and he's got these two kids he's taking for the weekend. And he's on the run from the aliens who are just going around murdering everybody. People are just dying left and right, getting turned into dust constantly, the whole movie. And he's got his daughter. His son runs away and wants to see the clash between the military and the aliens. And there's a big dramatical point at that. But then rightly after that, he takes his daughter and is taken into the basement of a house for shelter by Tim Robbins, Tim Robbins' character. And so then they're hunkered into this basement. And they get visited by this kind of probe, like snake thing, that goes around with a big eye on the end of it and is looking around for victims. And so they successfully evade that. They're running around in the basement while the probe is looking around and it misses them. It can't find them. So maybe it thinks it's empty or whatever. The probe leaves. And then these four or five, like, aliens come down. And they come into the basement and they're looking around. And they successfully avoid these aliens. And there's kind of a clash at one point. Tim Robbins' character has a shotgun, and he at one point is pointing it at one of these aliens, and he wants to shoot the alien, but then Tom Cruise comes up and is like, no, don't, and they're struggling with the gun for a while, and they're trying to do it really quietly because Tom Cruise doesn't want to invite the aliens to hurt him or his daughter. So he successfully calms Tim Robbins' character down, and then the aliens leave. Then this is where it gets interesting. Tim Robbins' character, he goes to another part of the basement, and he grabs a shovel, and he starts digging. And he starts being kind of loud, and he starts kind of yelling. And Tom Cruise is like, be quiet, man. You got to be quiet. Please be quiet. If they come back in here, they'll kill us. They are going to kill my daughter. I can't have you doing that. And he's screaming, he won't be quiet, and he won't be quiet, and he won't be quiet. And Tom Cruise is eventually like, okay, daughter, here, I'm going to put this blindfold on you, and you plug your ears. And you just wait right here, and I'll be back. And so he goes in, and he murders the Tim Robbins character. Okay? And this is where my question comes up. Is he morally justified in murdering this Tim Robbins' character? Now, we got aliens around the house. We don't know where. They just came in, and they just left. Would they just come back in again? Don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Probably. But is he justified in quieting down permanently, or even attacking him at all, this character who is digging this ditch? I mean, he's kind of going crazy. He's like, I'm going to dig my way to, I forget where, maybe China or something or whatever, or dig a tunnel to somewhere where he can be safe. Or is Tom Cruise's only real morally justified position is to leave the basement with his daughter and try and find somewhere else and hopefully avoid the aliens that are around the house? Now, you didn't want to hear this question beforehand, so I'm hitting you with it. So what do you got? What do you think?
You know, that is a very tough question. You kind of have to put yourself in that position where you are hiding from somebody intruding into a space that is seeking to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone goes a little crazy and starts drawing attention.
Right.
So it's not as if you can just go somewhere else per se, right? Like, because you don't know where the other, you know, the intruders are. Right?
You're taking a risk. You're definitely taking a big risk by leaving the basement. But I'll say this, right after he kills the character, they leave the basement. But let's
like
leave that out.
Like
kinda. I mean, they leave the basement and then get caught by the aliens. So in a way he's right because the aliens just snatch him right up. So let's say that the external threat is real and he can't just leave without getting caught. Because that's what happens. But you know, maybe if they had left without killing Tim Robbins' character, they could have. I mean, obviously, it's in the script, so, you know, we're talking about we're trying to apply a real-life morality to a script, but, you know, let's say he might have, there's a small chance where they could have escaped and avoided the aliens. But, you know, given the benefit of the doubt, the aliens capture him, so that's what would have happened. So, go with that.
Yeah, and, you know, it's actually great because Murray used to do these things all the time, as I heard in some recollections, where, you know, he talked about, like, somebody owns a gorilla and the gorilla goes out and smashes a window. Who's responsible? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great thought experiment. I got to go with, you know, what did the character or the person know in the situation at the time, right? So they didn't know,
right.
you know, what the script was or that they would get out and that the aliens would find them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I almost feel like it's a self-defense situation. If you know that there is an active threat and they've searched that area and didn't find you and then they're still around, I wouldn't feel safe going anywhere else, right? Because they've sort of like identified this area as you're not there. So if someone were there after that, creating a nuisance or a noise that could draw their attention back, I would certainly think that there would be some kind of a, you know, you got to quiet them down, right? You don't want to draw the attention because the attention means death, right?
Right.
In your mind, okay. at least, right?
In your mind, if nothing else, right. If nothing else, you are acting. He believes, Tom Cruise's character, believes he is acting in defense of him and his daughter. It's clear from the script and it's clear from the movie that that's what he believes. Now, my question is just, you know, is he morally justified or not? And you are leaning towards him being justified, you think?
Well, and at the very least, quieting the guy down, preferably through non-lethal means, but, you know,
mm-hmm. right.
it's a, you know, there's murderers
the guy's gonna resist. He's
searching
stressed.
For you.
he's stressed. Tim Robbins' character is stressed out. He actually, Tim Robbins, in real life, he's like, you know, 6'3", and Tom Cruise is like 5'7". So, you know, Tom Robbins' character is a lot bigger and a lot stronger. So you would imagine that Tom Cruise, as if he, you know, initiated some sort of physical altercation to try and calm him down and quiet him down, to do it in a non-lethal way might be a little more difficult. It might be a little more of a proposition there. But, I mean, the movie doesn't show it. We get a closed door, we get some sound effects, and then Tom Cruise walks out. So, covered
what,
in blood, or at least with some blood on him. We're not actually told that Tim Robbins' character's dead, but we hear nothing else from Tim Robbins' character.
For the rest of the film.
For the rest of the film, right.
So, how does Tom Cruise do this, then? Because, like, you said he has a shotgun, he blindfolds the daughter, but obviously a shotgun's a rather loud thing, so you're not going to shoot the guy. Right.
It's not clear. I don't remember if Tom Cruise had a weapon in his hand when he walked in the door or not. I know that, I mean, you know, Tim Robbins is busy frantically shoveling and he's got his back to him. So I assume maybe Tom Cruise picks up some object and bludgeons him or whatever. But there is a struggle in that we hear that lasts, I don't know, a good, you know, 10, 15 seconds. And then Tom Cruise walks out.
Okay. Well, it's possible he's not dead, right? Maybe he just knocked him out. A little
it's
bloody.
It's possible. But the look on Tom Cruise's face and the weight that it looks like it has on him kind of implies that he just killed a man. And he is feeling not great about that.
And he is such a great actor that you can read all of that.
That's right. You can see it on his face. You could just, yeah, you really get it. The man can act. I'm sorry, you can't. He's a crazy person, but... You know, well, Scientologists, you know, whatever. I'm not going to judge them all, but I just did.
So did we respond to your question? I think
no.
we did, right? I mean, he felt it was self-defense, and he should use some means to quiet the guy to eliminate the threat that he is drawing attention to them by the murderers in the house.
Yeah, I mean, he does use some verbal means to try and calm him down. He does talk to him for a while. He talks to him for like a minute, probably, trying to get him to calm down. And he won't, and he's still yelling. So, you know, I do side on the idea that Tom Cruise attacking him is self-defense, but it is a kind of a sticky, little interesting kind of thing. At least he believes it's self-defense, and I'll go along with him.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to think that as well, because, like, even if the guy is crazy, imagine if he was a crazy person, you know, with, like, some kind of a weapon or something along those lines, you know, and think of the threat that's searching for them in the house as that weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he's crazy and not quite aware of what he's doing, he's certainly bringing an imminent threat to Tom Cruise and his daughter.
Right. Regardless of whether he knows it or understands it, he is at least threatening that weapon to be used against Tom Cruise and his daughter. So in that sense, I think Tom Cruise is justified. I would have preferred a non-lethal method. I would have preferred that he spend a little more time and effort to find some sort of an object, maybe, you know, tie the guy up with, or put a gag over his mouth or something. Or
well, like you're saying, he's much bigger than him, and I mean,
it's true.
I would argue I'd like him to Debo his ass, you know, like from Friday, Chris Tucker and Ice Cube. You know, you got knocked the fuck out.
Yeah, I mean he's you know, digging frantically and he's looking away from you, so you could sneak up behind him and bludgeon him in the back of the head or something, and hopefully not kill him. But and I think
hard to say with a blow to the head. It's hard to say.
It's true, and I think you know Spielberg was going for the emotional impact of, oh man, the weight of what I just had to do. You know, I just had to kill a man, and he felt like he had to protect his family. So interesting. It hit me as a possible discussion point, and we just discussed it. So there you go.
There you go, audience. More where that came from.
Yeah, buddy.
Not that we can identify where that came from, but you know there could be more. Do we want to roll through another topic, or do we want to start wrapping things up?
What time are we at?
Well, I'm counting from when we started the call, and we were probably on for 10, 15 minutes before, so we're probably looking at 35 to 40 minutes on this episode.
And that's usually where you like to wrap things up.
Yeah, but if you got anything burning hot, you know, maybe it's a little bonus time for these folks or folk.
Well, you know, the things I got are like things that would take a while to discuss. You know, the parents' kidnapping issue, or maybe. I was listening to. It's just disappointing. I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast, and they had a guy named Sam Harris on, and I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but he's like this neuroscientist guy that talks about a lot of politics. He talks about Islam and how it encourages people to murder people and whatnot. And it was just really disappointing to listen to him because they spent most of the four-hour episode talking about politics and talking about how he's a Clinton supporter and how Trump is dangerous and whatever. And it just reminded me of, you know, all these people that love democracy. You know, how's that working out for you? How pleased are you with the choices you have? Everybody that says, you know, I love democracy, but it's an imperfect system. Well, what's a perfect system? People say that, and they're always disappointed by the choices they get. Well,
that's the Churchill quote, right? Like, democracy is the worst form of government other than all the other ones that have been tried before or something like that.
Yeah, except for all the other ones. Yeah. In that movie, SLC Punk, it reminded me because they refer to anarchy as a political system, and that annoys me. For those who don't know, SLC Punk is this movie about some kind of punk anarchists in Salt Lake City in the 80s. And I just started watching it. I mean, I watched it years ago, but I'm watching it again. And they refer to, the anarchists themselves refer to anarchy as a political system, and that's like a political system in that not collecting stamps is a hobby. It's the rejection of a political system. So in that sense, anyway, it just annoys me that when anarchy is mischaracterized. So I didn't really have a point there. Just rambling at this point. You got anything?
No, rambling's good. You know, I think that there is a lot of misinterpretation on what democracy means, what anarchy means, what anarcho-capitalism means. And maybe those are some future topics that we can discuss. One book I would recommend on people who are interested in just learning more about how democracy isn't the great thing that you always hear about is a book by Hans Hermann Hoppe called Democracy, the God That Failed. And he discusses many of the problems with democracy and obviously the things that it has led to. I mean, if you look back through history in the United States, the whole idea and concept of the Constitution was to bound the government in chains. And it's led to, and this is a Stefan Molyneux argument, led to the greatest, most expansive, most intrusive and violent and virulent government in history known to man. So how's that working out for you?
Indeed. And, you know, the reason I don't vote is because laws are enforced at gunpoint. Anything you vote for becomes law. And therefore, when you vote, you are pointing a gun at somebody's face. And people don't see the immorality of that. It's baffling to me.
Yeah, well, that reminds me, a couple of years ago we talked about the GMO labeling, and at the time you weren't as interested or involved or acquainted with, I guess, our way of thinking now, and so you were sort of in the position of like thinking that was a good thing to vote for GMO labeling on things as a self-defense measure, if I recall
right.
Your thinking.
That was my argument at the time. My thinking at the time was that it was a self-defense measure because there have been studies done that track, you know, the dangers of it. And it's usually, they show up through the generations. I mean, generations down the line are when the effects are worst seen. So, I mean, just the idea that I would like to be better informed, be able to make my informed decision when I go to the supermarket, hey, this is GMO, hey, I can make an informed decision whether or not to purchase this item versus that item. But your point being that, well, you're enforcing a company to comply with something that they wouldn't normally otherwise do. I mean, they may be incentivized by the market to do that, which is perfectly fine, but when you're using a government gun to force a company to do a thing, well, that's immoral. Now, as a self-defense, and I've heard people make this argument as why they vote when they'll, you know, turn up to vote no on an issue. And usually it's like just no across the board. Don't do anything. Stop doing anything. Don't do anything. And they're saying that they're voting, you know, self-defensively. And I have less of a problem with that. I think it still legitimizes the system in a way because you're essentially giving the thing this mechanism that is granted to you as like the only way to affect change or something like that, like as an effective way to make change or to better your life when it's – you don't improve lives by politics. And there are winners and there are losers, but well, as I said before, violence doesn't solve problems, creates new ones. So nonviolent means are the ways – you know, voluntary exchange, voluntary interactions are the way that people improve their life by definition. Voluntary exchanges improve all parties.
At least ahead of time. Like, they go into it believing that.
Yeah, so much as they believe. I mean, maybe they're mistaken. Maybe I buy that product and it turns out to be a piece of crap. That gives me information for the next time. Or
you mean like that Obamacare insurance?
No, that's good stuff, Daniel. Good stuff. You need to get some.
Like so are you saying that my argument was that, what you just stated, like 3 or 4 years ago? Because that sounds fairly sophisticated. I'm impressed by myself from back then.
No, what you said was argue from first principles. That violence is wrong, that enforcing that the NAP was true and that it was correct and moral, and argue from that point on. Do not initiate force against a company to do a thing just because I wanted them to do it. To force them to do it is wrong. Make it desirable for them to do it would be perfectly fine. If I were to say, hey, I want to buy products that are labeled, you know, GMO-free, and I convince everybody else around me and all my friends, and I get a huge swelling of support from millions of people, and everybody wants GMO-free labeled stuff, then the market will probably label their goods GMO-free if they are and whatnot, and they'll see a market response based on that, and their products will sell better, and that's a perfectly moral thing to do.
Yeah, I think I recall having an argument at the time that there's nothing precluding people from putting that on their food products.
Well, no. Monsanto did sue people for doing that. They labeled – somebody – I forget. This is going off some old
memory. Oh, this is the RBST thing, right?
I don't know. But
the cow hormone, growth hormone?
Might have been salmon. It might have been the GMO salmon. But it was something where people were labeling it GMO-free. Monsanto said, what are you doing? By you labeling your product GMO-free, that makes it sound like our GMO products are bad. Therefore, you are causing us a harm. Therefore, we're going to violently attack you and force you to not do that. So there may be some precedent that prevents companies from labeling their products GMO-free.
Oh, well, that would be unfortunate. That would be an intervention in the marketplace.
Indeed.
Yeah, well, since we're in bonus time, I'd like to take this opportunity to swing us back to the draft and a conversation I had with somebody 4 years ago. And almost 3 years ago. And I'm sure I told you the story before, but I was at a party and there was a discussion about the draft, and this person thought that the draft should be re-implemented because it would make people like more involved in their government and in their country and you know, be greater people, whatever. And I had a conversation with this person and said that I thought it would be better off if people were allowed to choose what they wanted to do, like, you know, say they wanted to go and create products or create value for somebody. That would be a better use of their time, not being forced into something at gunpoint. And I guess I should describe that this person was in the Vietnam War and didn't take too kindly to what I was saying and decided to get into a physical altercation with me. Do you remember this conversation?
Sure do.
Yeah. Now, I'll bring up the fact that I was wearing my three-week-old daughter at the time that this person decided to physically push me and want to get in a fight with me and only held back by other people who were nearby. And I guess it's just an example of these people who have accepted the doctrine of statism and how strongly they hold these beliefs that they'll get violent when somebody questions them. You know, it's quite frightening.
They are mentally and emotionally invested in them, in that they have spent their entire lives living with it. So, I mean, if you go into the Vietnam War, you go through this horrific experience, you want to justify why you had to go through that experience. Say, you know, you did it for a good reason of some kind, and then you got somebody coming out and challenging that and saying that it wasn't a good reason. That kind of attacks their entire justification and their mental well-being for that decision, if they voluntarily did it or not, I don't know. But, yeah, I can see why he reacted violently. I mean, obviously he's wrong, but we're dealing with people that are, to use an overused phrase, in the matrix, and it can be tough to break him out of that.
Well, it almost sounds as if you are justifying his behavior. You're saying that I attacked him verbally with my words. I mean, does he need milk and cookies in a safe space?
Probably.
So that, you know, he doesn't assault me and potentially kill my daughter, who's 3 months old, or 3 weeks old?
I'm saying what he did was wrong, obviously. But what I'm saying is I can understand from his point of view why he felt threatened. Because here's a person, I mean, obviously he's not mentally capable of dealing with his emotions regarding this issue and the choices he made or was put through, his experiences. So I could see why it would seem as an attack on him for you to...
Like an imminent threat? Like an imminent threat to his person, therefore he can defend himself?
No.
Like physically?
No, a threat to his ideology, a threat to his mental well-being. Because here's a person who is probably used to using violence, had to use violence in the war, was rewarded for using violence, rewarded for killing people, went through this horrible experience, and it changes you, and you have to adapt to survive, and you see horror, and you do horrible things just to survive. And then you got somebody coming along and, you know, telling them how it really is, telling them the truth of the matter, and I can see you got this emotional investment tied up in, you know, this ex post facto rationalization of the things you did to be able to sleep at night. I mean, can you imagine all these war veterans who had to do these horrible things to survive? Horrible things. When they were just drafted into it, they were threatened to do it. They didn't want to. Then they had to do these horrible things to survive. Well, when you get done with all that, you have all these nightmares because all these horrible things you did. And so all you can really do is try to find some reason, some kind of justification, some kind of explanation, some kind of a way to make yourself feel at least a little bit good about what you did. You know what I'm saying? So I did a horrible thing, but maybe I did it to protect freedom or some bullshit rationalization. And then here you got someone coming along saying that, no, you were wrong, and that's dumb. Can't you see how that would be problematic, especially with someone who's obviously a little bit emotionally not good?
Well, it sounds like you're saying that you understand why he would do it, though you're not condoning it in any way, or at least I would hope not. Because, I mean, that was an imminent threat on my person and my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just words. And so, you know, had I been carrying it might have ended very differently, and you know, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, I mean, he could have murdered your daughter, and then you probably would have, you know, murdered him. It could have ended very horrifically. He obviously is not a complete human being, if I could make that justification or judgment on the guy. If he's going to attack somebody, and by, you know, by attacking that person, he's also attacking this three-week-old daughter because his ideal is challenged. I mean, you're not dealing with a, you know, an adult human being there, especially not an adult human being emotionally.
Yeah, he's like 50 or 55 years old or something.
Right.
And, you know, clearly, because there was an altercation and a bunch of people intervened, I was told I needed to apologize to the guy. And I didn't necessarily agree with that, but I attempted to, and he tried to attack me again.
Your microphone.
How do we sound now?
Better.
All right, so because there was an altercation, people got in between us and intervened, and I was told I needed to apologize to this guy. And when I attempted to, he tried to attack me again.
Why did you attempt to in the first place? You didn't do anything wrong.
No, I was instructed to by people who had gotten in between us, saying that somehow I offended the guy and that I needed to apologize. And they were telling him, you know, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Your great service was instrumental in keeping us free, blah, blah, blah. You know, so of course, you know, his actions were fully justified by the people around him.
Yeah, and he's been told that all the time.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing, right? Yeah. I wanted to mention this earlier when we were talking about, like, veterans and whatnot, how they're told, like, they get this, like, emotional benefit, being told that they're doing such a great thing and providing such service, and they get, like, special perks and benefits just from businesses and other entities in the world, you know, like,
veteran discount and all that, yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
and then they get treated differently. People thank them all the time.
I don't want to sound like an asshole, but, you know, and this is going to get some hate mail, but what about people actually provide value, who actually do something that's productive and benefits people versus what they've done?
Yeah, I'd much rather someone walk up to somebody, a business owner or some sort of service provider and thank them. I mean, here you're doing a thing that is directly benefiting my life. You installed granite countertops on my house. You cooked this delicious burger or whatever. Thank them for doing such a great thing. I mean, you're also thanking them with your patronage. But here's somebody who's actually directly improving your life as opposed to, and I'm going to sound like an arrogant asshole or some sort of whatever, but this perpetuator of violence that is going over and initiating violence on people, you're deifying and the heroification, if that's even a word, I'm sure there's a better word than that, but the heroification of a violent thug, of a person whose best response to a problem is to point a gun at it. Now, they're being told that this is what you do. The enemy has been dehumanized. They're horrible child rapists, and you're doing the world a favor by murdering them. That's what they're told. But their response to a problem is to point a gun at it. Now, how come when I do that, it's wrong, but when a guy wearing green does it, it's okay?
Or blue.
Or blue. Or any kind of costume. I refuse to call them uniforms. They are costumes. Any kind of costume. It doesn't grant you special morality. It doesn't grant you the right to do something that you wouldn't normally otherwise have the right to do. So when people talk about how they're heroes and all this bullshit, it's really grating. I mean, I understand the tribalistic nature of warfare, how when you get a group of soldiers in there, and they're really fighting for the man next to them. They don't really want to kill anybody. They don't want to really, I mean, some people do. But what they really want to do is they want to get through the experience, and they want to save the guy next to them because they're buddies, and you feel a kinship with them. I think it's the poisoning of nature, of government, that they would exploit that human emotion to want to save your friend and help your friend and protect your friend. It's exploited and used to murder and kill and destroy, and it's disgusting. I mean, government poisons all of everything, markets, human relationships, all the time, and it's really sad. It's really, really sad, and they don't get the blame for it. They get, you know, praise and wonderful on how wonderful government is and how they do everything so great and how much we need them. We have crime, so we need government. Oh, so we need more criminals to deal with the criminals? How about we just have the criminals we have? We'll just take that. How about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, since we're in bonus time now, I mean, we might go long here, but it's like the gun argument where people say they want to remove the weapons of war from our streets, but they're not talking about removing all of them. They're only talking about removing them from people who don't work for the government.
Right.
And
they're
Yeah. And I don't think people understand the consequences of that. You know, I mean, they might think that, like we were saying in the last episode, that it can't happen here, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you got Germany, you got Cambodia, you got Rwanda, you got Yugoslavia, any number of countries in history that disarm their population, and suddenly there's no ability to resist the government. And as we were saying, the government is the biggest threat to your person, you know, in your day-to-day life. Like, a terrorist attack is as likely as a shark attack, or even less.
Yeah, and then all the unseen deaths that come from, you know, the hidden deaths, like the FDA delaying a drug, all the costs involved in getting a drug to market. Not even, you know, the overt, you know, death by cop stuff. We're talking about all kinds of deaths that are as a result of government messing up with markets, with interfering with prices. There are, you know, price controls in Venezuela that make it so that the stores have to sell products below cost. Well, why would anybody do that? Why would you sell it for less than it cost you? So you got all these lines down there all the time, and people got nothing better to do with their time, apparently, than to wait in line because it's so productive.
Well, Bernie loves those lines.
Yeah, they're great. They're super awesome. But yeah, they interfere in every walk of life and cause all kinds of problems. I mean, Obama just signed in some chemical bill yesterday or this morning that's sweeping new regulations for chemical use in products. And I haven't really looked at it yet, but it's more interference with the market. So, you know, it's super sweet.
Yeah, well, if it's government, we can assume it's bad. You know, and that's the thing I wanted to draw a distinction between, because the people who are like this pro-gun confiscation or gun ban are implicitly assuming that government is inherently good by nature, and that if we remove guns from citizens but leave them with the government, that won't be a problem.
Yeah. There was one quote from a guy, I think it was a senator or a governor of Florida, I forget who it was, but I don't know if he was just using some hyperbole, but it was really dumb. And he said, an AR-15 can fire 700 rounds a minute. I mean, you have to pull the trigger 700 times because it only fires one bullet. I think maybe there's a burst fire mode where you can fire three at a shot, three per pull. But still, you'd be replacing a clip every 3 seconds. I don't know if there's any human being that can do that. But anyway, there's all kinds of deification about rifles now.
Deification or demonization?
That's what I meant, that one.
Yeah, deification of democracy and government, demonization of anything that potentially resists it or threatens it, like this podcast.
Indeed.
Yeah, so I'm sure that we're going to be hauled off at any moment once this is posted. So if episode 6 is it, folks, it's been a fun ride. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming by, guys.
Yeah, so that was a little bit of bonus time. It leads me to want to give more. But I think we can save it for another episode. This one hit like some recent, well, not so recent, but, you know, some like personal stuff for me, and that's kind of hard. But, you know, Robert and I have talked about that in the past, and so that's kind of why you got the short version of it here. Why don't we start closing this thing out? I wanted to bring up again that we've got the Pebble Watch Face available. It's the baller Murray Rothbard with the sunglasses, like our logo. You can get it on your Pebble Watch. It's a free download, so check it out. We've been running some Facebook ads and gotten 2,000 people to view it, which is kind of nice. A couple of people have signed up, and we appreciate you, so thank you for joining us. And you got anything else you want to close with? You want to give us an update on the book or where you're at on that?
I've just been doing a lot of the artwork associated with it. In promoting the thing, I'm going to be doing a Kickstarter with, and I'm doing all the artwork associated for that. So I'm going to be doing like some T-shirt designs, maybe a mug design, maybe, I don't know, a beanie cap design. I mean, I don't know. I'll be doing some art that you can put on different products to maybe put along with the Kickstarter, maybe like a poster. I'm also going to be doing the website art right now. And the cover is, I'm super happy with it. It looks super cool. I'm really happy with the artwork. It's interesting getting back into it. I mean, I've been associated and, you know, focused on, kind of on art like my whole life. I was more of an illustrator through high school and college and that sort of thing, and it's been fun to get back into that. So hopefully people like what I'm doing, but I like it. So if you don't, oh well.
Well, the market will decide, right?
It will. That's what it's good at.
All right, well, so that wraps up this episode. It's kind of a longer one, folks, but we appreciate it if you hung with us. Again, we got the Pebble offer. We've got the update on Robert Johnson's book, and that will be, what, out later this year? So please do check that out.
Kit Tamarack, Wizard for Hire.
Kit Tamarack. Tamarack or Tamarack?
Tamarack. Kit Tamarack, Wizard for Hire.
Wizard for Hire. All right, well, I for one, will read that book once it comes out. Another book I'll recommend is The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose. I think that's a good one to read. If anyone can get through that, they'll fully understand what we are talking about.
That's right. That's the philosophical inspiration for my book, so get into it. It's awesome.
Yeah, so that one's available at larkinrose.com, or you can just do the old Google search for that. You can find more of our podcasts and other information at readrothbard.com. We've got lectures, books, articles, photographs, this podcast, the free Pebble offer, and much more at readrothbard.com. We've also got the Facebook group, so feel free to check that out. And we really do appreciate you listening. And I think that's it. So thanks a lot, folks, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks again, guys. Have a good one. Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.